Hello, good morning. My name is Lily, and today I will be reading the Taunton Daily Gazette. This is the Friday, February 20th, 2026 edition, and we are starting off with this first article titled Fair Owners-Landlord Clash in Court. Hearing focuses on competing claims in the King Richard's Fair case, and this is written by Hannah Morse. Attorneys for the new owner of King Richard's Fair and its 98-year-old former landlord argued before a superior court judge in a duel over the attraction's lease and sale on Tuesday, February 17th. Lancelot Entertainment sued Alfonsi A. D'Amico Sr. in May 2025, claiming that he stymied lease negotiations in an attempt to create his own competing Renaissance festival. The business seeks damages and attorney's fees to be determined at trial. D'Amico followed up with counterclaims filed that September. D'Amico alleges breach of good faith and fair dealing, unfair and deceptive trade practices, and negligent misrepresentation, and he also seeks damages. Attorneys for both parties appeared before Judge Beverly Cannon in Plymouth Superior Court in Brockton to argue the merits of their claims. Cannon took the arguments made during the 37-minute hearing under advisement. Through 2024, King Richard's Fair had operated at D'Amico's 80 acres at 235 Main Street in Carver since 1982. King Richard's Fair is a 16th-century themed festival featuring handmade crafts, food, musicians, singers, dancers, minstrels, mimes, jugglers, whip artists, magicians, knights jousting on horseback, a royal court, and King Richard himself. It's a destination for thousands of visitors from Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and throughout New England. The fair was sold to Lancelot by its founders in August 2024. The sale amount was previously undisclosed, but Avery Topol, an attorney with Sheehan Finney representing Lancelot, told Cannon that King Richard's Fair was sold for $3.4 million. In order for the sale to go through, it required permission from D'Amico and payment to him in an amount that equaled 25% of the sale. Afterward, the two parties were in the process of negotiating a new lease, as the old one would expire at the end of 2024. The parties don't agree on how this process should look. Accusations of sabotaging the negotiations rent the land for the fair. During the Tuesday, February 17th hearing, Lancelot's attorneys painted D'Amico as a, quote, savvy businessman, who torpedoed lease negotiations to buy time to create his own festival. In turn, D'Amico's attorney described Lancelot as a powerful entity taking advantage of a 98-year-old man who sought to leave a legacy for his family. Topol said D'Amico's conduct had, quote, effectively sabotaged the fair for 2025, describing a chaotic, rushed few months to get vendors, seek town permissions, and reimagine King Richard's Fair in a new location. Quote, was there a fair, though? Cannon asked. Yes, was the response. Part of D'Amico's argument was that he believed the $850,000 paid to him from the business's sale came from an artificially deflated sale price and that he never saw financial documents to confirm that this was the true amount. Quote, we don't know what the specific terms of the sale were, and we can't plead that. That's the point, said Stephen LaRose of Nixon Peabody, who is representing D'Amico. Topol said that while D'Amico had a lease provision guaranteeing him 25% of the sale, it did not mean he had the right access to financial documents, and that D'Amico's belief stems from comments made by an unnamed industry source and not from a specific fact. Additionally, court documents describe a memorandum of understanding that the two parties had signed agreeing to a 10-year lease that would guarantee D'Amico at least $1.5 million in annual rent or percentages from various fair profit sources, whichever was greater. After D'Amico approved the sale, he claimed that Lancelot reneged on this agreement and returned to him with a $400,000 annual rent proposal. Quote, then they get him with the real kicker. That's when they tell him, after they've got his consent, they say, guess what, Mr. D'Amico, if you don't agree, if you don't like our new deal, we bought the property next door and we're going to move the whole fair over there, so take it or leave it, LaRose said in describing Lancelot's negotiation tactics. What about the Edaville Family Theme Park land? That property was Edaville Family Theme Park, which Lancelot would ultimately purchase for $8.7 million in February 2025, and where King Richard's Fair would relocate for its 44th season. Topol countered that a memorandum of understanding is, quote, not intended to be legally binding. He confirmed that Lancelot did inform D'Amico in fall 2024 that they were looking into buying another property as lease negotiations dragged on. Quote, you can't do that in negotiations. You can actually say, we actually found this better option, so you're going to have to do better, or else we're going to go with that. That's what happens to negotiations, Topol said. And he said earlier, you can do that in negotiations. Quote, it's entirely reasonable for Lancelot to have explored these possibilities. Further, Topol said Lancelot had every intention of continuing King Richard's Fair on D'Amico's property, and as a tenant, it did not have leverage. He told Canon that while D'Amico is claiming unfair and deceptive practices, these claims cannot be made every time negotiations go south. Quote, if you start allowing these claims any time a party backs out of a negotiation where things don't go well, then you're just going to be stifling free negotiations, he said. LaRose said that D'Amico did not have legal counsel at the start of the negotiations, and that the Carver property was, quote, a key critical piece of his legacy. Quote, it is core to his family. He wanted this property to be in good stead when he eventually, hopefully not anytime soon, leaves this earth and leave it to his family. What King Richard's Fair's new owner, Lancelot, claims. In court records, Lancelot cited public records in its claims that D'Amico attempted to create his own Renaissance festival and stalled lease negotiations, culminating to a full stop in discussions on February 20th, 2025. This was the day after Edaville's sale to Lancelot was finalized. The records include the creation of a new entity called Camelot Renaissance Village Limited Partnership, with D'Amico's niece listed as the registered agent on January 28, 2025, the submission of a Town of Carver automatic amusement and entertainment license application and one-day special liquor license on February 23, 2025, for an outdoor live entertainment event with 8 stages for several dates from August through October of that year, and an email sent by D'Amico's niece to town officials on March 3, 2025, referencing discussion of the possibility of hosting a Renaissance fair at 235 Main Street. In his counterclaim filing, D'Amico said each of the public record documents, quote, speaks for itself, and, quote, denies any characterization that differs from or misstates its terms. Lancelot claimed that D'Amico changed the locks and prevented its representatives from accessing the property in early 2025, but D'Amico said they had no right to the property after the lease ended and locked the property once it became clear that Lancelot was not acting in good faith on a lease extension to protect it from further unauthorized access by anyone who could act with bad intent. The company alleged that D'Amico repeatedly made false statements to Lancelot and that his conduct, quote, constitutes unfair and deceptive trade practices. What former King Richard's Fair landlord Alfonsi D'Amico claims. From D'Amico's perspective, he described the hardball lease negotiations including, quote, misrepresentations, intimidation, and threats. D'Amico was to get at least $1.5 million in annual rent from Lancelot, or various percentages of sales from the fair, whichever was greater, according to a written memorandum between the two parties. as part of the lease agreement, Lancelot was required to pay D'Amico 25% of the amount that King Richard's Fair sold for. He received $850,000, but said he was not supplied with financial documentation to confirm that this was correct, the correct amount. He believes that the sale price was, quote, artificially lowered to reduce the sale participation payment owed to D'Amico. Months after D'Amico agreed to the sale and signed the Memorandum of Understanding, he said that Lancelot came back on October 20th, 2024, with a draft proposed lease that sought to set the rent at $400,000. He said Lancelot, quote, shockingly suggested that if the parties could not agree on the draft lease, it was, quote, prepared to relocate our business. Lancelot also sent D'Amico a cease and desist letter that accused him of, quote, actively attempting to sabotage Lancelot's ongoing business operations at King Richard's Fair. D'Amico, quote, had D'Amico known the Lancelot entities were going to obtain his approval and then wholly disregard their prior representations and try to squeeze entirely different lease renewal concessions out of him, including drastically lower rent, he never would have consented to the purchase, the counterclaim filing said. D'Amico claims that he continued to negotiate the lease until, quote, the full truth of Lancelot's intentions was revealed in its purchase of Edaville in February 2025. He claimed he was unaware that Lancelot was in talks to purchase Edaville during its lease negotiations over the summer. Additionally, D'Amico claimed that Lancelot stole large wooden entrance doors and caused property damage. D'Amico's claims include breach of contract, breach of good faith and fair dealing, negligent misrepresentation, as well as, quote, unfair and deceptive conduct. In a motion to dismiss filed in October 2025, Lancelot says that D'Amico's counterclaim, quote, lacks factual support and do not plausibly describe unlawful conduct. All right, now moving on to our next article. This one is written by Lourdes C. da Silva, titled Rhode Island Man Traces Family History to Portuguese King. When genealogy aficionado Keith Tavares started digging deeper into his Portuguese roots and family history, he could not imagine what his journey into the past would unearth. The Newport resident not only uncovered stories and connections that define his heritage and have shaped his family's legacy, but also found surprising family ties to monumental figures in Portuguese history. Quote, I descend from the family of Nuno Alvarez Pereira, he told O Jornal. Quote, I discovered his sister, Violante Alvarez Pereira, was my 19th great-grandmother. I descend from his father, who was the Prior do Crato. Known as Constable of Portugal, Nuno Alvarez Pereira was a legendary 14th century Portuguese general who played a decisive role in helping Portugal secure independence from Castile and is best known for the historic victory at the Battle of Alhuberota. His father, Prior do Crato, was a grandson of King Manuel I, who claimed the Portuguese throne during the 1580 dynastic crisis. Through his research, Tavares discovered that the maternal branch of his family was among the original settlers and founders of the island of Fael in the Azores. Quote, my ancestors were the original Flemish leaders who arrived from Flanders and were sent there by the Portuguese crown to help settle the island of Fael, he said. His ancestral journey led him into writing the recently released book in Azorean Family's History, Our Faria and Moitoso Roots. Quote, discovering these things made me want to write this book, Tavares said. It made me want to share those things I discovered and confirmed through expert genealogists who had already done the research and transcribed the parish records in the Azores, reaching all the way back to the original founders. Book will resonate with many Portuguese Americans. Tavares has Portuguese ancestry on both sides of his family. Quote, my great-grandparents immigrated from multiple locations in Portugal, mostly the islands including Faial, São Miguel, as well as Madeira and Cape Verde, he said. The self-published book focuses on his maternal family tree branch, first on the island of Fayal and later in Taunton and Newport and Middletown, Rhode Island, where his Faria and Moitoso relatives planted roots in this country. Although the book is focused on his family's heritage, Tavares said it should resonate with many Portuguese Americans because it is a good example of a typical Azorean family who immigrated to this country. Quote, "It's a very good example of what most Portuguese Azoreans that immigrated to the U.S. went through during that time," he said. "What it was like for them to settle here and assimilate and join up with other Portuguese-American community members and be a part of the Portuguese-American community. My great-grandfather really was a big part of building that community here on Aquidneck Island." Tavares says the book was a passion project. Tavares said the book was the product of a childhood dream. Quote, "Years of capturing the images, stories, and information about my ancestors have finally paid off," he said. He started collecting names, dates, photos, and stories as a young boy. Quote, "I spent a good deal of time as a child very interested in my family's history, listening to their stories and taking notes," Tavares said. "I remember sitting in my grandmother's living room while she folded laundry and just asking her questions and writing down her answers. And the same thing with my grandfather when he was working in the garage on his workbench." While he was studying political science and history at Boston University, he sent a 2-page questionnaire to his grandmother and 3 sisters. Quote, "They all returned the survey completed with all the information," he recalled. As genealogical technology advanced, Tavares furthered his research using digitized online records, complementing it with a trip to mainland Portugal, the Azores, and Madeira. The new tools allowed him to efficiently analyze data sets and vast records and break through previous research limitations. He began writing the book during the COVID pandemic. Quote, "It was a passion project," he said. "It kept me focused. It gave me purpose in a time when, you know, the world was flipped upside down." Tavares, "It's important for me to share the Portuguese story." Tavares said the beginning of the book touches briefly upon his early ancestors and how he discovered that information with the help of a group of genealogists who traveled to the villages of Cedros, Flamengos, and Castelo Branco in Faial and described the respective parishes' records from the early days of the original settlements all the way up to 1911. Quote, "I became friends with one of the genealogists who shared that information with me," he said. "Through these confirmed transcribed records, I was able to confirm that my great-grandmother descended from these early founders and leaders on the island of Fayal, so it was just an incredible story." Tavares said his family first set foot on American soil in the late 1800s. His maternal great-grandfather arrived from Fayal in 1897. Quote, "He wanted nothing to do with the family's roof tiling business," he recalled. "He was an adventurer, and he wanted to go off on his own. So he came here alone at the age of 16 and went directly to California, where he stayed with relatives." After getting married, his great-grandfather traveled to Fayal to introduce his new wife to the family, and shortly after, the new couple settled in Taunton. Quote, "She died after giving childbirth, and he remarried in Taunton to my great-grandmother," Tavares revealed. "They had 8 children together and moved to Aquidneck Island because she had already settled in Newport with her siblings. So fast forward to 1957, when the Capilinos volcano erupted in Fayal, and that, you know, really impacted the rest of the Faria family. The volcanic eruption displaced close relatives and destroyed the family's roof tiling business and farmland, forcing his great-grandfather's brother to immigrate with his family to East Providence. Tavares said the book paints a picture of his family's life on both sides of the Atlantic over several decades, but its main purpose was to share with one example, the history of Portuguese Azorean people. Quote, "It delves into not just my family," he said. "It really delves into the surroundings and the environment during the time, this time of immigration." Tavares also talks about his 2003 trip to Faial in search of his roots in the book available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Blurb, and other online bookstores. Quote, "Connecting the two worlds and bringing them to life was important to me," he said. "It was important for me to share the Portuguese story and, more importantly, the Azorean story." Sharing his knowledge about genealogical research tools and resources. Tavares, who has worked in higher education and the nonprofit sector for about 30 years, currently serves as director of capacity building for the Rhode Island Foundation. He has given multiple talks about his family's journey from the Azores and genealogical research tools and resources, most recently at the Institute for Portuguese and Lusophone World Studies at Rhode Island College and the Middletown Historical Society. He offered some advice for those interested in starting family history research. Quote, "There are so many resources out there. You just have to know where to look," he said. "I think the best way to start is, if you're on Facebook, look up Portuguese affinity groups or Portuguese genealogy or Azorean genealogy affinity groups, and that is where you will get the most mutual support from others like you." Tavares said the key is to start small. Quote, "Build your connections and then everything else will fall into place," he said. "There are so many database systems out there and ways that you can connect with your ancestry. There's so much for Portuguese Americans to discover about their heritage and their ancestry, and it's a history that is so much easier to discover than it was just 20 years ago. There's so much that they have available to them." What's next for Tavares? Tavares's ancestral journey has led into writing yet another book. Quote, "I'm currently writing a novel," he said. "It is historical fiction, and it's based on the lives of those early ancestors in the first part of this book. It's built around the facts of their lives and relationships. I'm hoping to have it done and published within the year." Next up is this short little reminder titled, "Taunton Residents Face Excise Tax Deadline with Fees for Late Payment." This is from Beth McDermott. Residents in Taunton are reminded that excise tax bills were mailed out February 17th. The bills are due March 19th, according to a community announcement. There are several options to pay the excise tax bills. Here is how to pay the excise tax bill. Online at taunton-ma.gov, bill and plate number required. By mail to City of Taunton, P.O. Box 4160, Woburn, Massachusetts, 01888-4160 as the zip code. In person at City Hall, 15 Summer Street, in an after-hours drop box is available at the rear of the building. Bills that remain unpaid past March 19th will be charged a $25 late fee 14 days after the due date, according to the announcement. If residents do not receive a bill, they can call the collector's office at 508-821-1054, and if a resident no longer owns the automobile, they should contact the assessor's office at 508-821-1011. Next up is this article by Beth McDermott titled, "Free Classical Music Program at Middleborough Church." Little Songbook Opera invites the community to attend a food-themed musical performance at 2 p.m. February 22nd. The event, titled La Bonne Cuisine, will take place at First Unitarian Church of Middleborough, 25 South Main Street in Middleborough, according to a community announcement. The program will feature works such as Bach's Coffee Cantata, Bernstein's La Bonne Cuisine, Bernier's Le Café, and the world premiere of Kevin Lubin's new opera, The Perfect Challah. 8 professional and local artists will perform, offering a classical music experience for all ages. Admission is free, but attendees are encouraged to bring a food pantry item as a form of entry. All donations will go to the Matthew Morrison Food Pantry in Taunton. The pantry's greatest needs are pasta, pasta sauce, ramen noodles, and canned vegetables. This final article for today is written by Anne Safir, titled "Reduced Immigration Slows Job Growth." The recent drop in unauthorized immigration to the United States has slowed employment growth, particularly in construction and manufacturing, and those trends are likely to continue, new research from the San Francisco Federal Reserve, published on February 17th, shows. The study looked at the rapid rise in unauthorized immigrants beginning in 2021 and the slowdown that began in March 2024, and found that local job growth grew and then shrank in lockstep with those immigration trends. The findings could have important implications for the job market outlook and for housing affordability. Revisions to jobs data published last week showed the U.S. economy added only 181,000 jobs in 2025, a fraction of the 1.459 million jobs added in 2024, the final full year of former President Joe Biden's term. Economists have linked the slowdown to the sharp drop in immigration, but this latest study helps make that link concrete by its detailed analysis of unauthorized worker inflows and the impact on local labor markets. Quote, on average, places experiencing the biggest slowdowns in unauthorized immigration saw the biggest slowdowns in employment growth in construction, manufacturing, and other services, wrote Fed economists Daniel Wilson and Zhao-King Zhao. The Trump administration has said the reduction in immigration will benefit American workers and will help make housing more affordable by reducing demand for homes. And with that, that's all the time we have for today's reading of the Taunton Daily Gazette. Once again, this was the February 20th, 2026 edition. Thank you so much for listening to the Talking Information Center, and I hope you have a wonderful rest of your day.